The...
Do you want to be introduced?
Yes.
Just like to hear what you can say.
What I say, this is Charles Eckhart, and well represented already in the contemporary poetry art camp.
Yeah, far too well represented. No, we won't put you to the test. The best introduction I've ever had was in front of a really quite a big room by a friend of mine who shuffled up to the front and said, well, that's Tom Clark. And shuffled off again. Anyway, I'm supposed to do a poetry workshop, and I've been thinking about it ever since Helen asked me, and I think that I'm not really capable of doing a poetry workshop. The name has a kind of metaphor which I don't think is quite apt, at least in my case. It suggests like a carpenter's workshop, or a craftsman's workshop, a place where things are made, they're put together. And if you go to a carpenter's workshop and you see them put together a table, you can then have a rough idea of how it's done. And you can hopefully go away and have a go. And the great thing about a carpenter is once he's learned to make a table, you can do it again and again and again and again. My problem with a workshop is I have no sense that I'll ever be able to. I'm constantly faced with the idea that the last poem I've written will be the last, that I'll never be able to write another. And I think that that's a kind of crisis that any creative artist has, any genuine creative artist, and it's absolutely inseparable from the business of creativity. I mean, one can learn how to write verse, you can learn the rules that has to be so many syllables, or has to be certain line endings, and you can learn to do it. But that's something quite separate from poetry, which to me involves this risk of that it's something you might want to have a manage. However, having said that, what I can do is simply read through to you a selection of work that uses very, very different forms. And you can see at least the kind of tables that I've made in the past, if not the kind of table that I'll make in the future. there's something else to be said about that, that I'm a person who used form, very, very different forms. I've used forms all the way through my career, and constantly gone into new ones. And in the beginning, they were very avant-garde, in the sense that I was making up my own forms, I was discovering forms, inventing forms. And of late, they've tended to be a bit more traditional. I've taken to traditional forms which are new to me and just used them and tried to work with them. I would say that I was a formalist in a restricted sense of the term, which is that I'm a poet whose main impetus to writing is a formal one. That is, I have an urge to make poems, to write poems. I'm not somebody who has got something to say, an experience or an idea that he wants to get across, which he finds a form for. I'm somebody who wants to make forms. Where the term formalist breaks down is that, having reached that point, I don't want forms to be empty. The great trick, it's more of a conjuring trick than a carpentry joke, is being able to use forms and have them inhabited by some sort of content, to enliven forms and make them do things for you and hopefully for other people. That's, having said which, I'll just read through mostly some of the early stuff, because that's when it is very formally different all the time, and just let you see some of the forms that I've used. The early work was all very timely, it was all tiny little jeweler's work. And it was at a time, the first two books, there's one called Still Alive, and the other one they're called Madder Lake, and they both use painterly titles. The reason for this was that I was attempting to make a sort of poem which would be like a painting, Still Alive, which would be one point that you would do. It's kind of an impossible, contradictory thing to do with poems, because poetry is an art of time and music. But I was trying to do something that went against the grain, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Anyway, the I had a very constructivist idea of things in those days. And the first little poem sets that out. Place words end to end as dry stones, using only local materials, arrange them sparsely to admit plenty of ventilation. They will stand among the fiercest winds and keep the sheep out. This is kind of constructivist ideas, isn't it? And all good poetry should instantly contradict itself, and the next one is more in the way to do with music. Although there's a painterly analogy as well. There's a poem called The Garden, which is based on one of Andrew Marvel's poems, famous called The Garden, annihilating all that's made to a green thought, a green shape. The garden. Green thought, green shade. Blue thought, blue shade. Yellow thought, yellow shade. Red thought, red shade. Blue thought, green shade. Yellow thought, blue shade. Red thought, yellow shade. Green thought, red shade. Yellow thought, green shade. Red thought, blue shade. Green thought, yellow shade. Blue thought, red shade. Red thought, green shade. Green thought, blue shade. Blue thought, yellow shade. Yellow thought, red shade. Red thought, red shade. Yellow thought, yellow shade. Blue thought, blue shade. Green thought, green shade. If you look up the back, you'll find a silent version of the same thought, etc. You can sort of, I'll try and leave space where you can accuse me of doing unspeakable things. This is one called The Daisy Chain. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Symphony in C. Spring, summer, autumn, winter. Furrow. The consonants are straight ridges of dark earth. The vowels, troughs of light, meet on the horizon. How do you tell a Staffordshire shepherd from a cloudless sky? By the deeper blue of his smocking. This is a kind of reference to Basho. It's called Japanese. a full moon, an old frog jumps in. Chamomile lawn, please walk on the flowers. These are little three-line ones which are the most still life-ish in Gutenberg. All untitled. Round orange, red apple, ripe pear. Clear skies, blue flags, calm seas. A book of poems, a vase of daffodils, a glass of water. A moorhen's wake, a pebble's ripples, a clown's found poems from a section called Old Fashioned Flowers, and they're just descriptions of flowers taken up. The title is, of course, very important. Honesty. This plant requires very little culture. It's sown in a bed of common earth. Soon after, the seeds are ripe. It thrives best in partially shaded borders or in the wild garden in moderately virgin soil. Scotch thistle. The juice of this medicinal plant is said to be good for a crick in the neck. Perhaps this is fortunate, for a flexible neck is needed when studying this grey-leaved giant, which may reach heights of 10 feet or more. With its more flowers, it makes a splendid summer windbreak. Similar still life. Pebbles. Place a few pebbles in a bowl of fruit. Their dull forms are restful beside ripe apples. Their smoothness is more inviting than the rinds of oranges. Be wicked, I'll read you a little group called From the French. These are translations of little French phrases. Le vert paradis, the green paradis. Lark au ciel, lark in the clear air. Le pain de la vie, pain of life. I'd better stop at that point. I'll read you, because there were a couple of flower poems there which used a description. This is a little group called Nine Roses, which consists, and each poem consists of the name of the flower in a one-line description, taken from an encyclopedia of roses. Devotion.
may require protection against mildew. Elegance, resisting bad weather well. Independence, now superseded by more brilliant varieties. Lyric, a modern shrub of medium vigour. Peace, well known all over the world. Purity, large white flowers, now rarely planted. Tradition, non-fading, but lacking in scent. Vanity, often flung fullest in autumn. Yesterday, forming a wide, graceful bush.
Gee, this would be too much to have that code for vanity. If we all
sort of found. To gas my mouth. I don't want to linger too long on this, so I'll just be kind of worried you're about our name. Let's see if it's all coming up. One called Jazz. And it's based on a quotation from the American novelist William Saroya. He says, "A school of minnows darting in a shallow stream is jazz. Clear brook tumbling over pebbles is counterpoint. A pair of orange tips fluttering in a meadow is mountainside. A cloud of dust motes drifting in a sunbeam is chamber music. Patch of thistles lurking in the floor is dissonance. A herd of deer stepping in outlines is plain song." Set of haiku, or things based on haiku. I read the Japanese poem earlier, and I don't know if you know the most famous haiku of all, it's one by Basho, about a frog jumping in the pond. And I can't remember what dent Basho wrote that in, but forever afterwards, Japanese poets were always writing feline 17 syllable poems about frogs jumping into or out of ponds, usually with the moon overhead somewhere. So this was sort of an attempt to work in that little tradition. Except for some reason I couldn't make 17 syllables work and manage that note. So I locked it to 13. it seemed to kind of lie better with the language. So the collection is called Frog Leaps 13 Times, because there are 13 little poems in there, 13 syllables in each poem. Frog Leaps 13 Times. To stand on the edge of night's wide swamp, puffed up with song.
sense between syllables, playing relay frog with silence. Croaking cicadas, I bathe my ears in spring water. As the moon climbs, pebble after pebble, briefly shines. A saucerful of milky light for small wayfarers. Ripples spread and are still. The moon retains its balance. In mist, the syllables sound, lending a voice to medicine. Quote, the croak is amplified by sacs, like little balloons. Unquote. A frog among pebbles, or a pebble among frogs. Looking at the stars from under green painted eyebrows. Into transparent water to spawn thin labials. Tadpoles and commas. Commas and tadpoles. Tadpoles and fresh jasmine petals fall. A poet stirs his teacup. I'll read just one more from this book. He's called The Dappled Blade, and all the things collected in here were done as tiny little books by my own press. And at the time I did this, I used the term of a page as a stanza break, so you get a poem lasting over and it's played, sort of orchestrating the song. It's called The Dappled Blade. Deep in the forest, deer are drinking cool, fresh water. In the forest, deer are deep in drinking cool, fresh water. In the forest, deer are drinking deep, cool, fresh water. I want to move on to sort of later work, I think. I'll move on to a book called 16 Sonnets, which was done about 4 years ago, although it was probably about a year older than that. And the work, as you see, starts to get a bit more discursive, a bit longer. These are all 14 my sonnets. They're not regularly run, although a couple of them have run. I've done this and another book called Out of the Wind, a few of which I'll read again. 32 in all. And I've written a few more since. And the idea about continuing going back to 14 lines is to attempt within that space make as many different claims of poem as one can and still keep it fresh. So I think that people do with sonnets anyway, they usually write a block of maybe 650 sonnets. The first one is
an old bard about the song of the dawn tearing out into the world. As I walked out early into the order of things, the world was up before me. As I stepped out bravely, the very camber of the road turned me to its purpose. It was all a morning early. I put design behind me, hearers and deliverers to the hazard of the road. In all the anonymous places where the couch grass grows, watch over us and keep us to the temper of the land. This is an annotation Celtic spell. It used to be a thing they did in the Highland districts when they picked a plant to bring medicinal or other purpose. They would say a little spell that kind of reinforces its properties. This is an imitation of one of them. I will pick the smooth yarrow, that my voice may be gladder, that my words may be arrows, that my syllables be hard as tide-tossed pebbles. May I be an island in the sea. May blue sea asters cover me. May I leap upon the hillside. I will grasp the spear thistle, that no man shall wound me. May no rumour find me. I will weave the thistle down. I will be a wind-blown reed. My souls will lure the sun. This one is kind of Robert Louis Stevenson situation. So. Chase across the heather. Our boat touches the bank among a scent of bruised sedge. The startled heron rises, broken from his austerities. We are in a proud country where stone chats to stone, where first pods crackle open, grey grunts and curlews inform. Keep well below the horizon, your flesh spare upon the bone. Trust to flintlock and sabre, bend down among the heather, the wild fiddle music of the air, tuneless. Find you anywhere. This is a piece of weather lore. When cattle sniff the air and herd together in corners, rain will invariably fall. When bees fly short distances, dogs lie on the far side to save, to forecast rain. When singing frogs croak, when toads come forth in numbers, it is a certain sign of rain. When swans fly against the wind, it's a sign of coming. When moles are more industrious, when worms appear on the surface, when they surely forecast rain. It's
what is made up of phrases from some prison letter by Rosa Luxemburg, written when she was in prison, sort of commenting on the fact that within a very sensory deprived environment, you make up a whole world and got very little information. My eyes that were hungry dwelt gladly on these stones, the stimulus of varied tints, as if when parched with thirst, I had been given a drink. On the monotonously grey sky, there towered a huge cloud, like a smile, like a greeting. And I stretched out both hands towards such colours and forms. I shall send you a line, farewell, till we meet in my new prison. The sky and clouds come with me. I shall not take leave of them. And the last one that I'll be from this lot is about a certain kind of modernist painting. Now in the modern fashion, but which uses areas of very cool colour. And it's sometimes forgotten by nowadays that early modernism had a kind of utopian programme behind it. It wasn't just theoretical formalism, it was some kind of blueprint for a new world. Anyway, this is that kind of theme. Each colour sits beside a colour of equal repose, so that each colour shines with its singular luster. At the edge of each colour, another colour is poised, so that each colour present is brought into the present, yet the present is not its cause. Each colour dwells in its place, neither turning towards or away from its immediate neighbour. Colour sits beside colour, all together in good order. I think I'll just read a few more of these. Here's. These are more sonnets, so I'll continue. And the first one I read is another song, Dawn Song. But this time it's the morning of a battle and there are armies drawn up. It's really based on a few, very much embroidered on a few phrases in Caesar's Gallic Wars. We drew up in good order upon the embroidered. Our lines still fresh and rested, and commanded to quiet beneath a storm of pens. The sky began to clear, and the sun shone brightly, but we held to the symmetry of our allotted disposition. Our closed ranks were as easy to intimidate as a hedge. Recalcitrance was our pledge until we tried the tactic of noise on the innocent
is yet another Dawn poem. And it uses this convention of lovers who are at the part at dawn or get up or whatever, whatever the sun is sunny and welcome. But in this case, the lovers are not Romeo and Juliet, but they're sort of, they might be two fisher folk from the east coast of Scotland. Under the quiet, strict tunnel, we are hauled up to dry. Two rusty liners, you and I, in a reach for backwater. Your hair folds over the pillow to drag me in its undertow. The wave of desire comes full in a gale or sudden squall. Remove your knee from my groin. The sun is in the rigging, and glad worms are wriggling with impatience for the hook. My old accomplice, come, let's present ourselves on deck. Another Scottish poem. This is A Blessing on the House. Again, in the Highlands, they used to, this was saying spells, they used to say blessings for every act that they did. And they used to also, when they came in, they came to visit somebody, they would walk in the door and they'd say, A Blessing on the House. A blessing on the house, from flags to roof tree. May its chimney never tremble, may its lintel be confirmed. A tune always in its hearth, brightness in its threshold. May its latch be lifted, may its well never fail. With fresh bread on the table, a health in every glass, a blessing on the host, a blessing on the guest. May there be trust between them, light and shade in their conversation. One is a description of a girl, just a portrait of a girl, 17 or 18. The girl holds herself for a gaze or for the dance, gathered about a line that runs deep down into the earth, transfixing her breast, her heart. Gentle, laughing, stir. Each mood is as if born out of a distant compassion that yet comes readily to play about its object of attention. In a room or in the street, all angles agree to meet discreetly in power. Yes, this one is another Chinese poem, not Japanese, but Chinese this time. There was a convention of Chinese poetry that lots of them were written by exiles, people who had been sort of government officials, who were sent into exile. And there's lots of poems about old friends meeting somewhere in exile, having a drink together, getting drunk, and the other one going on the next morning. But there's, you always have to get drunk, and again, there's always got to be a glimmer of the sky. So this is the kind of invitation. While the lopsided moon leers above the hawthorn, let's take the best of the air. Good friends come from afar to meet here on the border. How can we hope to stay sober? Tell me all the news of home. Tell me how the winter clove flowered before you left. Tell me, are the world's affairs still in the hands of fools and liars? Pass again the barley wine, and try the night with a tune. They must drink deep and part soon.
Can't stand it.
No, I'm very good.
Nice to meet you.
The last one is just a description of leaf growth on a tree. Patiently each prepares in the open air around it, its rightful place alone, similarly balanced and forms. Every glint of the sun, all oppression of accident, is passed on from one discrete form to another in a community of interest. Through all the varied shifts, the concessions and infringements, each new bud and shoot attends and confirms an equity laid down in the wind. I'll go through a couple of little series and then we'll have a break and talk and if I can find them. Some years ago I produced this little called Three Triolets. And it says here, pretty what a triolet is, it says, the triolet is a strict verse form of eight lines, of which the first line is repeated as the fourth and seventh, and the second line is the eighth. So these are three triolets. Having done which, I had a sort of guilty conscience and thought that I ought to have a go at writing some actual real triolets for Margaret's in. And these are the results, unpublished as yet. The thing that I didn't explain in there, which is equally crucial, is that it has to rhyme throughout. You're only allowed two rhymes in the whole exponent. Is that jiggling away? I can draw your attention to it. So these are, in fact, six triolets. The idea of the repeated line is that you're supposed to attempt, at least, to make it sound slightly different each time through the context. The first one is not this sort of morning interior. Dust motes hang in a sunbeam. The curtains lift and fall. We lie awake, we do not dream. Dust modes, time and sun. Things between us are just as they seem. The moment is as solid as a wall. Dust notes behind the sunbeam, the curtains left and fall down. We'll get one more beautiful word. This is a kind of base, there's a painting of Cornish painter called Christopher Buddha called Fisherman Dancing on a Key. This is based on that. The fisherman dance on the key to a bagpipe, fiddle, and drum. When the wind and the tide agree, the fisherman dance on the key. In an angle of elbow or knee, the sea is the colour of love. The next one is also based on a picture by another Cornish painter called Ivan Hitchens, who has in fact a series of pictures called Ways Through Bracken. There are ways through Bracken that the feet never find unless the heart is broken. There are ways through bracken where no word is ever sunken that is tacit or unkind. There are ways through bracken that the feet never find. And this one's based on a little upon a line in a girl in the lemon grove, your eyes are so blue, the haze of lifts where you move. Girl in the lemon grove, the dust is quickened with love round each print of your shoe. Girl in the lemon grove, your eyes are so blue. This is another moon poem. In the rain barrel all night dips a drunken boat. It writes itself half tight in the rain barrel all night. It's a single swollen light. Self-importance keeps it afloat. The rain barrel all night dips a drunken boat. The last one is an imitation Chinese hermit poem. There's lots of Chinese poems about hermits living on mountains going silent cuckoo. On the bare mountain slope, laughter comes and goes, as fugitive as an antelope on the bare mountain slope. The sun lets down a rope, and the green moss glows. On the bare mountain slope, laughter comes. Okay, we'll finish off with your free gift. Better. It's called After Cavalcanti. it has a quotation beginning, a simil de natura ben non parta. Helen will tell you what that means. it means something like ben, good. Good is not slow to seek out similar natures, to draw other goods towards it. I don't know if you know anything about Cavalcanti. He's a friend of Dante. Like Dante, he wrote in that tradition of writing love poems to his lady. Poems which were ostensibly love poems, but in fact were philosophical poems. They were, the lady was kind of, was not a lover, she was a remote, inaccessible figure in whom all the poet's idea of good was embodied. So she became, as poem says, a kind of, was he says a mantra, she becomes a kind of a meditation point for his, the poets and the poetry's spiritual attainment. You can see why they have to be kept at distance. this is if you'd be able to live up to it. this particular poem works on a very simple principle where Cavalcanti lists a whole lot of things that he thinks of as good, as being pleasant, as being fun things. And then he ends up by saying, well, all these are all very well, but my lady's absolutely better. The first one was written in response to Cavalcanti's call about a year ago. And it kind of, I sort of liked it and wanted to chip away at it a bit more. And it occurred to me that although this isn't translation, it's a kind of imitation, that one could go on doing that several times. You know, why stop the limits of taking that little group of images? Because I've substituted, of course, images in my own. Anyway, my good draws other goods around it. The parched earth after rain. Words that fit to an old tune. A glow of embers in the grate. A conversation by a gate. A half light in a birch root. The bell canto of a blackbird. Laughter, passion, good talk. Quinces and many sentence stop. Better by far than all these is the sense and loveliness of my lady. Her least act has joy for its effect. I would rather attend her and hear a kind word from her than climb a mountain alone or slip out of harbour at dawn. A brisk walk on a cold day. All the words we needn't say. Light cross-hatched with shadow, dried grasses by a window. A rain of hazel pollen, kisses awarded or stolen. A rock shelter in a gale, a circle of trees about a pool. None of these is as fine as the tact and discrimination of my lady. Her gentle mind is as clear as it is kind.
Whatever is good moves inexorably towards her, proves itself in her presence, and there learns of its essence. A graceful figure of speech, grand colonnades of beach, a lark rising above sustained chords, a clash of keen-edged swords, a shoulder moving under satin, the equal syllables of flatter. 4:30 in the morning, the sails of a windmill turning. All these are things of worth, yet of less value than the hearth where my lady presides, stern, keeping the very air from harm. All contours incline her way, a glance can no more pass her by than a man can part from the shadow, or a crane's gull flit across a meadow. A form where the content dwells, a jug from which sunlight spills, Argentella lace, drifted snow, two heads on the same pillow. A long, ornamented melody, windows open on a balcony, a gift of gold, a handshake, pleasantness among kinsmen. None of these can compare with the high altitudes where my lady walks in candor, the colors disposed about her. Clouds part for her sake, the fields and the hedgerow make along the course of her way, loud fanfare for a holiday.
Actually, that mention Italian, it just struck me that there's a line in Hans Cantos, which is a sort of again an imitation of it.
Is it?
In the gloom, the gold draws a line together.
Absolutely, I hadn't thought about it.
In the gloom, the gold draws the light, which is a kind of sound language.
That's wonderful, yes. That's obviously where it comes from, isn't it?
And he uses it in relation to kind of Renaissance, Italian Renaissance, but it can be present.
Yeah, right. Well spotted. Well spotted. Good detective work, yes. I'll pencil that in while I can. It's beautiful, that use of it, isn't it?
Because he takes it out of the kind of the theoretical into a...
into a real, yeah. Well, that's, in a way, the difficulty with our poetry is that it is, or at least at this distance, it can seem very theoretical and dogmatic and cold. And what I tried to do was to use things that I liked, rather than to translate Cavalcanti. I tried to substitute things that I liked in order to kind of warm the poem up a bit. I did not succeed. But, I mean, that's, I suppose the point I started to use that is because that's kind of my view of poetry. That's the job that I like poetry to do for me, is to kind of increase the sense of good, the moral sense, or kind of assemble images. It's another pun, quotations in there, but attempting to make a poem of these at the rest. And And that's the kind of thing that I attempt to do as well. I don't mean that I attempt to make it like poem, but I can at least make it for myself, or to summon the images which it might
compose. How important is it to write in that microscopic way? So, because I'm living in, or just listening now, the kind of the idea and the theme of exile of existing in a state of contention with some implied outside world.
Yes.
As you were kind of reading through this, and both seem to come back as a theme, but also as a form, and
yes,
world of objects, but words as objects, playing off of mm-hmm. each other. There's
very
a lot of tension there.
Yes.
What your sense of the world, the space outside of it is, and how necessary that kind of edge is in order to work.
Do you mean the social edge? You mean the difference?
Yeah, well, that was the question in my mind. I didn't wonder what it was, but it's like a metaphysical.
Yes, right. Well, there was a review in PM Review of another book of mine which kind of said just that. It said, well, these poems are all very well, they're all very well managed, but whereas can you do it in 1984? Is it then and the thing that I think the reviewer missed there was that, in a way, its remoteness from 1984 is surely part of the point that kind of we live in a world in which to think about things you like is almost a crime. And there's the kind of vast area of criticism there, which I don't overtly like, but I think that it's there as you say, as a definite tension.
Sorry? That's not one where they became excited. That's when we should read again.
That might be a solution. I don't know if that kind of contributes anything to a workshop idea.
Just to be perverse, the thing that struck me is what you said about the kind of the risk of the writing again.
Yes.
And living with that sense of creative tension.
Yes. Yeah.
Or angst.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that I don't think I've ever got you to talk about. But I mean, even though you think of yourself as a formalist,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, how does it actually get? How does the other thing come?
The risk of the tension.
Well, I mean, how does a poem actually get itself made in terms of how does it get made formally? What is your experience of that?
Oh dear. Well, it's usually come. All those things are like the Chinese poems, the Celtic spells, etc., etc. They're all things that I've come across in reading, and I usually think, "Gosh, I like that. I'd like to go with that." And so I try it, and in the process of trying it, I'm trying out a new form, and I'm also trying out a new idiom. But I attempt to make it mine. I mean, like in the Cavalcanti thing, where I bring in things and images that appeal to me. And in that way, I kind of bring it home for myself.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's the
side
that quite interests me. I mean, how. Yeah. This sort of the sense that you have a kind of a unique lyrical voice as well as sort of your own personal range of images.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, does it happen that there are times when that is there for you?
It does. Yes, it does. I mean, one does have. I don't want to make it sound too cold, mechanical. When this appears, where it kind of flows, and you think, and you, but But again, it almost has a kind of formal impetus in that I write half a dozen sonnets that don't work, and then I reach a point at which they do work, and the mind at the top of your head just comes off, because you don't know where the images have come from, and you don't know why you're writing about this rather than that. And it must have something to do with reading, it must have something to do with the whiteness of one's reading, as well as the business of walking about the world and seeing things. Because one very often working with a form, that's the challenge, that's why I keep changing forms, is because when I come across a new one, I can't do it. I work at it, I can't get the swing to work. And you have to reach that moment of frustration when you think, I can't do this, it's impossible. And when you get beyond that, suddenly you can do it. And it all starts to work, and you think, oh, that's all right. And it seems fine. And you do that for a while. You maybe get a little, I mean, that's how all these little groups of poems have been assembled in that way. And then after you reach that point, you reach another kind of dangerous point where you've learned to use the form, and you can always do it. You can sort of think, wait, I can turn out a sonnet now, you know, which would be about today. But that's the point that then it's dead. Got to throw it away, yeah, and you've got to find another form that's kind of challenging and more sharp up your responses. But that's the kind of risk element, because one's learned to use all kinds of forms, but learning to use them is no use to you. It doesn't work, it will never allow you to write a poem for some reason. There has to be that tension that we create. For me, at least, I don't know what it's like. I would think it was the same. So, could you
say? Well, I just find that interesting. I think increasingly the combination of success and time is one which achieves what it sets out to do, whether that's a limerick or,
yes,
or whatever.
Yeah.
And what you were saying sounded very self-conscious, that you mentioned formal exercise becomes a challenge and one you kind of grapple your way with inside. But do you set yourself a task in which there's not a prescriptive form, or there's not a prescribed form, it's not you don't know it's going to be high people or solid, but you know you're trying to do something.
Yeah. I mean, very often the form emerges
in
the process of writing. It's not always that one's got a solid earlier. I mean, I suppose it's 50-50. But very often I find that the kind of, if I sit down with an idea for a work, it never works out. That idea's always got to be discarded. And I've usually, what I do is I work away at an idea, and I arrive at a form that I'm happy with, but the idea doesn't fit it. I mean, there's all kinds of peculiar perversities involved in the business of writing, which no one will be able to sort out. But the exciting part about a form is always when you're using a form and something magical happens that you can't control, and you know that something else is, it's sort of become inhabited, as it were. And that's the kind of point that one's always working towards. And very often, when one learns to use the form, you continually get things that you think, oh, that's pretty good, and that's pretty cute, and all the rest of it. But when you're honest, you've got to admit that this extra ingredient isn't there, in which case it's no good at all. It's just clever writing. Which is really no good to mind that beast.
And it's that extra magical ingredient you can't actually...
It's that control. You can't account for it. You can't ask for it. You have it on tap.
Is that what interest in plantations and fishermen and shepherds and magic?
Well, that's a kind of palette of imagery in the one that I use. But it's everybody has their own palette. I mean, Mondrian didn't use ochres and sepias. I've got my palette, but the reason that I use that particular palette is because those things appeal to me. I have this childish longing for innocence and quiet, which asserts itself whenever I tend to write. So the palette I use is a pastoral one. But it's interesting because it also, by coincidence, as it were, turns out to be largely the palette that's been used all the way through English writing for all kinds of personal, formal, political concerns. You know, whenever an Englishman wants to convince you of the status quo is right, he will delineate it in terms of flowing rivers and rolling hills. In other words, he will attempt to naturalize an entirely conventional or cultural situation. And that's an ingredient in my work, but it's an ingredient that's in question.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye.
When you were writing these, as it were, after couple commentary, the one that starts aggressively after the speech, you seemed a bit hesitant about the line being called Sylvia's button.
Did I?
I just wondered whether there are sometimes lines that by the time you finished, you're not quite so confident about it, sometimes.
Yeah, I think I'm quite okay about that. I've never read it before. I mean, I think that's wrong. I mean, it might change my mind. but I had a bit of reading it because I haven't read it before, and I was thrown by every new line, because every line is different from it, at least until you get halfway through. So it's very difficult to keep hold of the sense of it while you're reading. You know, usually if you're reading, you sort of know what comes next, and your mouth forms the song, because you know the idea. But when there's a new idea every line, I mean, I'm not well enough acquainted with it yet to read it coherently.
And is it that, I mean, all of these are as the bearings on the one poem?
Yeah, on the idea of that one poem, which is of various. There are one or two images which I can't quite remember now, which crop up and
what sort of images
did
he use?
Well, he uses all kinds of different images as well. But they're very much courtly images in the sense that they're about this one about I think high prows or carved prows on high seas, and it's all about knights ready for battle, which I've sort of betrayed in the keynote swords. And they're very much that kind of courtly, knightly sort of stuff.
It struck me that in each case it was the third stanza that was most kind of cavalcanti.
Really? Yes, it is.
Yeah. I mean, there's a problem when you get down to that kind of language, touch and discrimination.
Yes, exactly.
Sense and
loveliness.
I mean, you're caught, aren't you, in that chivalric corkage.
Yes, there you are.
Ethic. And the vocabulary of it, even if you're trying to kind of demystify.
Yes, right, exactly. Absolutely. That's right. But I think that I'm probably, you know, I understand that, but I kind of go along with it. I mean, I'm some sort of Platonist who believes in categories. I mean, one tries to break them down and then the rest of the whole and personalize them. But nevertheless, when one comes to talk about the actual things, as opposed to the things that make it up, one is in tonic language.
Isn't there a danger then, because some of the images are from personal but also accessible to us?
Yeah.
And things like the parched over after rain is a starting point.
Right.
I mean, there's a real kind of sensual, tactile experience that we all know about.
Yeah, right.
And experience doesn't have to come from literary experience.
Yeah.
So that when you start deploying this very specific vocabulary in a very specific sense of my lady or Madonna or whatever, that you're moving in two registers at once.
I just think that you are, yes. It's something that isn't quite there in Calcutta, because he does use, both the examples he uses are already in some way conventional.
Well, they're part of the code and
they're part of the code, right. I think that that's a problem, that's just a contradiction or something. I don't know how they talk it.
I think it's partly because I'm worried about the whole notion of lady as mantra.
Yes, I
which can be very seductive, but also very dubious.
Yeah. That's right. The poem is, in some sense, and quite deliberately over the top. It kind of intended to do it, so that would be put it too strongly, but I became aware that I was at one and the same time accepting Cavalcanti's categories, but also pointing out that to have all these examples and so they say that your lady's a bit better is in some way kind of ridiculous. But that kind of ridiculousness I've attempted to use as a kind of charge, you know, as a kind of, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying, to kind of lift the thing. I don't know, put it more graphically.
Well, I don't know, I mean, when I
read,
I would rather attempt to hear a kind word from climb a mountain alone or slip out of harbour at dawn. I didn't quite believe the speaker. I kind of thought that to climb a mountain alone or slip out of harbour at dawn would be definitely more preferable.
I see. I was trying to be manly there.
Sorry, that's probably utterly subversive.
Idealized figure, the one saying that the thing that one perceives in the good, as it were, is better than any particular good. You know, that's what the poem basically says.
What
motivated you to imitate it? It's a very beautiful poem, it's a great poem. And what's a deeper reason than that? As I say, I am a kind of Platonist. I do see poetry as doing that job, as holding out images of the good, or the good life, or images of the way that we might be, or the way that we might live. And my poetry is always a poetry of might rather than is. And for that reason, I'm very much an odd figure in the contemporary scene, because the predominant strain of literature is and has been a realist one, saying this is how the world is. And my poetry says this is how I would like the world to be. So it's different, it's a kind of anti-realist. I think one of the reasons is because I feel it presumptuous to tell people how the world is. I sort of presume that they know at least as well as I do. It would be monstrously presumptuous to tell people how the world should be, which is what a lot of philosophers or politicians or tell us. But I think that it's the job of the arts to tell people how it might be, to hold up desirable images, to play on people's affections. And the kind of the reason that to translate or imitate Cavalcanti, one of the reasons it seems so odd is because the sensibility that's perpetually played on in contemporary literature, less so that's still there in contemporary art, is sensations of outrage, and anger, aggravation. And a kind of very different Barbie imagery is one that's not really understood.
I still have problems with my imagery. I know you're writing what might be some kind of utopian. Or some platonic poetry at that point. I think my emotions are in outrage.
What is it about the lady thing?
Yes.
To
kind of return us to that confusion between, as it were, a platonic ideal. In the mind, or as a kind of a poetic, or a moral, or a mythical name, and the sort of the personal my lady, which is confusing it with the loved woman, or whatever.
I think friendly understanding convention doesn't confuse it with the loved woman, because that's not what the figure is.
I know it's a convention, but I still. I wish almost that instead of saying my lady, you could say anima or something.
I see the argument you're making.
Because it does tend to push the notion of what it is to be female back into that sort of very. Stars, conventional world of walking in candor and
Is that what you all do?
No.
Gosh, I'm learning things today. Yes, I absolutely. I see that.
And this is another, it's another way of finding a phrase. I suppose that's what it comes down to for me.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I see that whole argument that you don't want to end up with stereotyped females, of, you know, that maybe the next step would be to shove them back in the kitchen or whatever.
Well, in the way, I'd rather be in the kitchen
than...
Remotely wafted fashion discretion.
Yes, I see. I think that the sexual thing is. I think that it's in some way unfortunate, I mean, it's my lady for two reasons. One, because it's there in Cabell County, and the other because I think that even when one makes all allowances for individual women, there is a kind of there is a sort of male tendency which is kind of fortunate or otherwise to look for qualities which aren't necessarily characteristics or qualities in women or in particular women. And I think that that's an inseparable thing from being human, that when the people you like for certain things in them and you would ignore other things in them. And that the people you like and the people that you admire for certain qualities which you think they possess, which you don't possess.
I think that's quite dangerous, actually.
You think that's dangerous? Mm-hmm. I think it's inescapable. I mean,
I think you're probably right, but I don't feel comfortable with it. That's the point. It is right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, if you ask somebody why do they like somebody, they will list, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But it is possible to like and respect somebody doesn't hold or have the qualities that you necessarily
admire. Of course.
And also, they don't speak before into ones that females have and ones that males have. Mm-hmm. I mean, if anything, the qualities that you respect individuals for are qualities that male and females have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no quality essentially that, you know, one can't have.
I agree with that. I wouldn't kind of dispute that. What I'm talking about though is much more a question of, we're talking about morality here. We're not talking about how people are, again, we're talking about how they might be. And it's not that one is saying, although one's using a sort of my lady business, and I can see your objection to that, it's not one saying that women should be like this. What we're saying is that we should be like this, we should all be like this, because that is a good that I particularly see and that other people might see and that they might want.
I'm also worried about the whole kind of Cabell County and philosophical stance which is moving towards very elevated sense of what is good to.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a real worry about the new prejudice in that.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of aspiration towards things which seem to me, I mean, the further they're cut off from the elemental, the better they appear to be in the scale of values.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that doesn't actually coincide with mm-hmm. I mean, for me, you know, an image like the Parched Earth of the Ring.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I would prefer that to the remoteness of my lady walking in tact and discretion or walking in candour when she isn't a lady anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, don't you think that kindness is better than the parched earth after rain?
Well, kindness doesn't mean much to me unless it's actually grounded in.
Of course. I totally understand that. I totally understand that. I don't know how you can separate the thing out though from any kind of moral argument. Morality is all about we should be like this rather than we should be like that. Or we should be more like this rather than more like that. And that's the reason why one uses the language of this rather than that. That's why one says such and such is better than such and such. That's why one says that all the essential images are pretty good, but a certain human sympathy is better. I think that perhaps the thing of these poems is that it hasn't put the actual the preference in more specific language. But I think the fact that the preference is there is absolutely real. And what I'm chipping away at in these poems and in others is that kind of aspiration which seems to me very important, seems in danger of getting lost, of the fact that we should act better towards one another. And I don't know how they talk about that as yet in anything other than a moral language. And that's why, the poem's bound to fail in the sense that one's saying, you know, this is good and that's good and something else is good, but there's something better. That's what I think the poem's attempting to do.
But the thing that's better, I think, is the thing which is least achieved.
Mm-hmm. In the poem.
In the poem.
Yes.
And at least realised and most kind of translatories.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well,